You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a beautiful winter day. And Don, I have sunshine here. Do you have sunshine there?
You can say a bright, beautiful, sunny day in Northern California. It is sunny as I look out the window, and we've got a break in the weather and a major change in the weather coming. We've been through 6 weeks of the dreariest weather I can remember here in Northern California, going back way back to the 1980s for anything comparable, with a number of days of fog, then followed by rain, cold, warm rain, you name it. We've had it over the last several weeks. Well, it is January 7, 2026, as Lois and I are preparing this for broadcast on January 8. The temperature at the University Airport right now is 48 degrees, going up to a high of 56 degrees today with patchy fog and then sunny. The sunny's already happening here in Solano County. Low tonight, this is relevant, 38 degrees, mostly clear. Thursday, day of the broadcast, will be 50 degrees and sunny, which is a few degrees cooler than it's been the last few days. Thursday night will be 36 and mostly clear, and there is a chance of frost on Thursday night. Friday will be 49 degrees and mostly sunny. Friday night, mostly clear, 35, and a pretty high likelihood of at least patchy frost, with areas of frost continuing into Saturday morning. The high on Saturday will be 50 degrees, partly sunny. Saturday night, patchy fog, mostly cloudy, so not much of a likelihood of frost, 37 degrees, and Sunday will be 52 and mostly cloudy. Here's the thing. Once that little stormy thing zips out of here, we're going into a long period of sunshine or fog. One of those two things are going to happen. We're not going to have any storms for quite a while, actually, from the looks of it. We've got, one meteorologist, Mike Kruger, who I follow on Facebook, stated, quote, after Wednesday's weak clipper, that's a clipper, apparently, with rain for the coast and snow flurries in the mountains, high pressure will build. As we go into the weekend, this will be the dominant feature through all of next week, if not longer, blocking any storms from moving in, giving us above normal temperatures. And he says we could also see the return of Thule fog in the valley. So,
oh no,
we're either going to have sunny days or foggy mornings and then sunny afternoons. What are those two things? So no rain on the horizon at all. And one other meteorologist was suggesting that the long-term look at this is perhaps much of the rest of January will be clear, sunny, without rainfall. So where do we stand on rainfall? Are we okay? Well, looking around the valley, Redding is at 133% of normal. Blue Canyon, 180% of normal. Sacramento at 9.6 inches, 145% of normal. Vacaville at almost 14 inches, 141% of normal. Davis is probably closer to that Sacramento number. We're probably 8 to 9 inches, depending on where you take your reading from. Stockton, 169%, Modesto, 180%, and so forth. So the water year so far, pretty good. Snowpack, better than it was, that's for sure. And average rainfall in the month of January in Davis is 3.7 inches, and we've had about 2.7 inches for January. So even if we went through the rest of the month without rainfall, things would not be too bad. Chilling hours, we are fine. Okay, let's just leave it at that. We're absolutely fine. 700 plus by the Utah method, 500 plus by the old method. Fruit trees have basically gotten what they need already, and we continue that count all the way through February. So as far as we can tell, the fruit trees are all going to be fine in terms of chilling hours. 6 straight weeks of fog and overcast pretty well took care of what the deciduous fruit trees need for their chilling, at least here in the Sacramento Valley. As noted before, I'll be very curious how you all come out outside of the valley because, well, we weren't freezing. Well, we weren't freezing. It just felt like it. Well, we were really cold down here in the valley back there in November and through the middle of December. The rest of the state was warm and above average. So we've had our chilling hours. We don't know for sure whether you've gotten yours. Fruitsandnuts.ucdavis.edu. Find the nearest weather station. Personally, I recommend the Utah method because we feel that that's probably the best, most accurate way to describe what's happening with chilling. You have four different choices when you get there. Check it out and see where you stand in terms of chilling hours. Fruitsandnuts.ucdavis.edu. A great resource with all kinds of other information, by the way. KDRT is community radio. That's public radio. We rely on contributions from listeners like you to fund our operating costs. If you like what you hear, head on over to kdrt.org and click on the support button. And we got a catered alert.
We did a live in studio production Friday, January 9th at 2:30 on the radio station. They will broadcast this live show, and here's the kicker. It's special consensus. Now, I don't know if you guys like bluegrass or jazz or any of that stuff, but Don, you've heard of special consensus. They've gotten all these awards.
Marking their 50th anniversary, vibrant contemporary bluegrass sound deeply rooted in tradition. It's a
Yes.
jazz-tinged instrumental, bluegrass-centered, award-winning recordings. 20, what is it? 22 recordings, two Grammy nominations. Anyway, this is a group that's been around for a while and very, very well known in the bluegrass field. And Rocky Outcrop, we'll have them as special guests. This is a special time in the studio. Another programmer what graciously allowed the overflow onto his hour so that they could come in, set up, perform live on the air, and have time to take it down afterwards. So check it out, kdrt.org. If you're listening to the broadcast, you'll hear it. If you miss it, head on over to the station page and download it and listen to it at home. All right. So
Okay.
we did have very cold weather, and we have some frost coming up. I want to mention the frost that we're looking at. The low temperature on those mornings is going to probably post at 35 or 36 degrees. So this is the kind of frost that will injure things that probably should have been killed 2 months ago. You're not looking at major injury to your young citrus or anything like that. I did, however, encounter one issue with freezing weather. A customer who brought in a plant and wanted us to look at it and assess it. So I sent you a picture. We'll start with this one because it's weather related. Why not? Not weather here necessarily, but weather related where it was shipped from. Do you see the picture I sent you of the leaf?
Are you talking about a fiddle leaf fig
I
there?
am. Yes, this
Well,
fiddle
that's
leaf.
an indoor plant. What's it
Yeah.
doing outdoors?
Well, it was being shipped. Okay, so this is a Ficus lyrata, fiddle leaf fig. Famously fickle of the ficuses, particularly
Famously fickle
famously
ficus.
fickle Ficus lyrata arrived at after she ordered it from one of the very well-known large companies that does ship to consumers as well as sell to retailers. This is a company that sells to big chains like Home Depot. They sell to independent retailers, but they also will sell directly to the public. Before the holiday, just before she ordered a Ficus lyrata, and it was shipped to her. The leaf that I found in the parking lot that fell off as she was walking in with what remained of the plant, I saved and took a picture and sent it to Lois so she could see what happens when a Ficus lyrata is subjected to freezing weather. Even in a package, even in a truck, apparently, or in storage somewhere, this plant obviously went down to the low 30s, possibly even below freezing. And I was curious what would happen if you took this leaf into, five different nurseries and five different hardware stores and showed it to the staff and said, "What happened to my plant?" They'd be looking at it going, "Bacterial disease. It's got some, maybe you overfed it. Maybe you overwatered it." She thought it got overwatered. Then she thought it was root bound and needed to be transplanted. Side note, sure. Yeah, it was fine to transplant. We went ahead and transplanted it for her. It had about five leaves remaining. All the others fell off as she pulled it out of the box when it arrived. Shipping subtropical and tropical plants in the winter is fraught with peril. There is the possibility that the truck that's carrying them will end up overnight in a place where it gets cold inside. There's a possibility they'll arrive at a loading bay and sit in the loading bay overnight or even for part of a day in many parts of the United States in the middle of December, it's going to be way colder than that plant wants. I know these big companies will often include a heat pack with them to prevent injury, but evidently that didn't work in this case if there was one. And the injury is direct cold injury on the leaves. I mean, it looks like a bacterial disease if you are thinking in those terms, but it isn't. It's just direct environmental injury. I can tell this mainly because I've seen this before. The next step will be bacteria will attack the mechanically injured, the frozen portions of the leaf. Well, there's bacteria that break down the necrotic tissue and will start to spread into what remains of the healthy leaf. It's very common for garden centers or even houseplant specialists to look at that and go, oh, your problem is you have a bacterial disease. You need to spray with this or treat with this. Your problem is cold injury on the plant, and there's nothing that's going to correct that. The bacterial injury that will then move into the cold injury and further into the leaf could be very problematic, and there is no spray for bacteria for a houseplant. There's nothing you can treat it with that's going to work. If someone says neem or something like that, laugh at them. It doesn't work. None of them do that, doesn't do anything. What you need to do if you're getting bacterial injury after a cold injury is remove those leaves, which is all the remaining leaves on her tree. So at that point, you have a bare Ficus lyrata. It's not going to sprout from the base or along the stem, very likely. More than likely, if you're lucky, it'll grow at the top. So now you'll have a tall stem and some leaves up there. That's okay if you like that look, but it probably wasn't what you thought you were buying. First of all, I did suggest she take some quick pictures and send them to the company because there's a very high likelihood. This is a very large company that does ship these things out. They'll almost surely just issue a refund, honestly. That's what most of them will do. You don't have to send the plant back or anything. Very high likelihood because they're a reputable company. They'll just issue a refund or a credit and she can do whatever she wants with it. Most of these companies understand that weather is a risk that they are taking. Read the shipping information carefully when you're ordering subtropical or tropical plants in the winter, because some companies may tell you that the risk is yours, in which case, well, you gambled and you lost. The plant's not dead. Pretty good chance it'll start to grow. Pretty good chance you'll have some new leaves on it when things warm up and things are brighter, going into weather that's more suitable now. I said, put this in the sunniest window you have, south exposure. No, don't put it outside. Put it in the direct sun in a south-facing window. Water very carefully. Ficus generally can go pretty long between waterings. They may not need water any more often than every 10 to 14 days at this time of year, especially since we just transplanted it. The high likelihood you can go as much as 2 weeks between waterings. There's a risk of rot because I couldn't tell whether the stem had been injured by the cold or just the leaves. It looked like just the leaves from the picture, but it's possible the stem has an injury, in which case it might rot above that point. But you'll find out pretty quickly. And a ficus can come back rapidly when it's happy, which means temperatures in the 70s in the sun. So if you can arrange that at your house right now, great. If you can't, a little extra light with a grow light could be very helpful in this situation.
I have a bunch of questions about this. So you say you just repotted it, or the person at home could repot it.
We did
And
just
then you
because.
said it only water every couple of weeks. Well, when you repot it, don't you have to like really, really, really water it? I mean, like soak it?
Water it in to settle the soil and water so that water goes all the way through. That was an important part of the conversation. She says, so do I just put a cup of water on this? No, we give you this big saucer. You put it in that, you water until the water is going into the saucer. You need to hydrate the whole zone. By the way, it probably wasn't absolutely necessary to transplant it now,
Right,
but
I
it's a
understand.
Ficus lyrata. They will need it anyway. So we figured, let's
Why
just go
not?
ahead and get that out of the way. Right. We generally do recommend, as one of our long-standing truisms here, when you buy a houseplant, it's probably a very good time to repot it because that's the way they're grown, and the soils that you choose will be better, in my opinion, for you to manage than the soils that they were grown in the greenhouse. But yes, an important point, water to settle, because we can't usually do that when we've transplanted something for someone. So we give them very specific instructions. Take this home, water enough to drain into the saucer. I would have you do it out on the patio.
But
It's
it's
a little
too
cold out
cold, Don.
there. So I'd rather have you do this inside. We do take plants out in this weather and we water them and we take them right back in after they drain out. Every one of us at our nursery at one time or another
Has
has taken a house
forgotten.
plant out either in the winter and forgotten and left it out overnight, or even worse, in the summer and left it out where it gets hit by sun in the morning and fries the foliage. So we all learn the hard way. Better to do those things in mild weather. But yes, very important to water it in thoroughly, settle the soil, and then probably you won't need to water again for, my guess, 10 to 14 days. It depends on how you heat your house and a bunch of other factors.
Okay, so I'm looking at this leaf. Now, if the leaves are still attached to the plant, but the edges are frozen and they turn black and would this be a situation where taking scissors and cutting into the green so that you've got a green leaf left, a part of a green leaf, would that help it make more whatever?
Yeah, if it hadn't fallen off, which it did, I picked this leaf up in the parking lot. But if it hadn't fallen off, you could trim off the burnt, dead, damaged. I call burnt, that's misapplication of the term. But you could go ahead and cut off the weather damaged portion of the leaf, the bacterially invaded portion of the leaf, and just monitor the edge very carefully. Most of the bacteria that attacks ficus and Schefflera and some of our other indoor plants typically attack from the edge first, has been my observation. Or if there's sunburn, they'll attack through the sunburn. Or if there's cold injury, they'll attack through that. These are bacteria that are always on these plants. It's not in your house. It's not something you can spray to prevent particularly. They attack a plant that's been stressed or weakened, that's lost the waxy coating that protects the leaf, or that's been directly injured. So that's why I'm concerned about the bacteria. Once the plant restores and starts to grow and makes that thick waxy coating again on the new leaves, you're probably good. The question is how long it's going to take to get to that stage. But there's a chance, there's hope. Unless, of course, the main trunk got injured.
So I think what I would take away from this whole event is don't order house plants in the winter.
Yes.
I mean, that would be my takeaway
Yeah.
because, it's not, we have very mild winters here, but
Here,
back
yeah.
east, it's freezing
Yeah.
and it's snowing and it's,
Well, and the place, here's the
look
thing,
at
the place,
where you're ordering from.
well, that doesn't matter because this is companies out of Florida. So Florida is fine, although Florida did have some freezing
Oh.
weather. But between Florida and California,
There's a lot of
unless
cold.
they
Yeah.
follow the, unless they ship it through the border states, actually, even that wouldn't do it. So it's the shipping is the problem. And it's also, I've watched this at the big chains, not wishing to disrespect Lowe's or Home Depot, but the way the things come in and they process them, it's not uncommon for them to arrive, be left in the boxes at a loading dock for a while. Sitting in the boxes, of course, they're in complete and total darkness. They then go from there to an indoor display that looks bright, but is mostly not the kind of light the plant needs to grow. So you may look at a display in a Home Depot and it's bright in there. There's fluorescent lights everywhere. Well, can't plants grow on fluorescent lights? Not when they're way up high on the ceiling. No. So it's not the right kind of light for them to grow. They've been through an extraordinary stress getting to the store. Pretty good chance they've been in darkness for at least 7 to 10 days. And now they're put out for sale. And it's very common for particularly ficus and Schefflera, but there's others that concern me with this, to start dropping leaves, to show stress. And more importantly, you've injured the leaf and you'll get that bacterial infection. So watch for that, prune that out as soon as you see it, either cut it out of the leaf or cut the leaf off. But be aware that midwinter is a stressful time to be shipping anything that's tropical, or in the case of ficus, what I would call subtropical. Ficus are pretty tough plants. There's plenty of people here in the Sacramento Valley, some USDA Zone 9B, where they have them outside after they're established. They're bigger plants. They set them by their front door, which is a sheltered microclimate, but it still gets down into the 30s. They're okay with that if they acclimate to it. Right out of a greenhouse in Florida into freezing weather, into darkness, and into your house is a recipe for disaster. So that's what we were looking at here. I'm guessing she can probably nurture it back to life, and she was rather amused by the possibility of having that as a hobby for a little while, but I did suggest she seek a perhaps a creditor exchange for it.
Okay, so we got lots of messages this week. And this one, the subject is it time to plant tomatoes? Don starts banging his head against the table. But it's okay.
It was an amusing heading to see on January 7th.
Yeah, thanks, Mary Kay.
We
You
loved
made
it.
a little giggle there.
Yes.
Okay, so Mary Kay lives in Folsom and writes, "Hello, Don and Lois. I love the Davis Garden Show. Thank you. You always give timely and useful advice. As new seed packets accumulate,
Oh,
I am
yeah.
thinking ahead to seed starting. So, yes, it's time to start thinking about planting tomatoes." And then she has lovely pictures. I have
These are
an
great.
unheated glass greenhouse. I use a small milk house heater to keep the temperature above freezing when needed. I use electric propagation mats with good success, but these mats have no thermal or control, no thermostat or control. After seeds like chard and lettuce have germinated, should seed trays be taken off the mat? After hardening off, can these cool seedlings and vegetables be planted out now?
Okay, we'll start with that one. Yes, we do them right on the same kind of heat mats. We find those are really the key to success with these small unheated greenhouses. Just if any of you are thinking of buying a greenhouse, a pop-up greenhouse or a small glass greenhouse, that's fine. Be aware that they don't, keep the place tropical temperatures. They don't keep it even that much above the outside temperature. They keep it enough above the outside temperature that you won't get direct injury on plants in many cases, but you definitely will need a direct heat source if you're trying to grow subtropical things like summer vegetables. However, lettuce, chard, things like that, it's well understood that almost all of those things germinate best at a high temperature. Lettuce sprouts great at warmer temperatures. And then as soon as they come up, it is best to take them off of that mat, harden them up a little bit, either shift them into the next size up to grow them on, or if they're big enough in the pots you started them in, go ahead and plant them out. But there is a period of transition from the heat mat to a little hardier to outside to the ground. Otherwise, you may get some leaf injury. Other than that, they go right out without much difficulty. Yes, this is a great time here in the Sacramento Valley, most parts of interior Southern California, all through the Bay Area, anywhere in coastal California, to continue planting leafy greens like lettuces, Swiss chard, kale, all those things can go in. And they do germinate great on those heat mats. So I think you're on the absolutely on the right track on that.
Oh, and then she says sends another picture, and I'm going to describe it for the listeners. It's there are nine, it looks like balls of dirt wrapped in paper is what it
Peat
looks like.
pellets. Those are peat pellets. Peat pellets are great. It's just peat moss with a little mesh thing around it, and you soak them and they expand and you plant the seed right into them. One of my favorite ways as a home gardener, too expensive for commercial, but one of my favorite ways as a home gardener for starting seeds, especially small batches where you're just doing a few of this and a few of that. These are great peat pellets. They also make them out of coir now.
So, is this the size of a walnut, the size of an orange? How big are these things?
Between a walnut and an orange.
Between a walnut.
Size
What's
of a
between a
small
walnut and
mandarin. There you go.
an
The size of a guava.
orange? They're one of those happy fruit. Okay.
Yeah, they're 3 inches,
All right.
roughly.
So, I'm keeping on in this question. These, the picture, are red velvet mini tomatoes.
That's a key data point here. Continue.
Because before I read the variety, Don was shaking his head and moaning. And after I read the variety, he was okay again. So, red velvet mini tomatoes, said to have some cold tolerance.
Okay,
I
let's stop
plan.
there. Cold tolerance in tomatoes means an ability to go into the low 40s. Okay, it doesn't mean low 30s.
Okay. Okay. I plan to repot these into 6-inch pots with good quality planting mix, hoping they thrive in the greenhouse until spring.
Okay.
Do they need to stay on the heating mats or require additional heat or light after repotting?
I would
I'll
do
just.
that. Let's do these one at a time. I would keep them on the mats for a little while if you can. Watch your indoor temperature in the greenhouse. I would recommend going back to to people who are getting pop-up greenhouses, buy a maximum minimum thermometer. Taylor brand is a very good one that's out there. You can reset it each day and see how cold it got in the greenhouse. And if we're getting into the 30s in your greenhouse, they should be on the mats. If it's staying in the 40s, this variety in particular will probably be okay. A sign that it's getting too cold, leaves beginning to discolor to purple. And we can talk more about what that means, but it would be telling you that the plant is getting a little more cold exposure than it prefers.
Okay.
Sorry, I threw you off stride there.
I'll be starting other tomato varieties soon and could use your suggestion on propagation. What's your procedure at Red Barn?
Okay, for that, we have heating
Now,
mats.
wait, before we get to that, you didn't say why Red Velvet Mini is okay.
Yeah, it's a miniature tomato. And this is a whole new category that's really coming into not just the seed catalogs. There's also an open, what you might call an open source breeding program where a bunch of breeders are cooperating and sharing materials back and forth. The ultra dwarf, the dwarf tomatoes, the miniature tomatoes, a bunch of different names for these. These are very compact, sometimes determinate, sometimes dwarf indeterminate. Come back to that in a moment. Plants that get a foot and a half, 2 feet tall, produce usually small fruit in great abundance. And it's generally been described as very good quality. I've only grown a couple of these. They were fine. They're just fun. But here's the thing, you can grow these in a pot the whole season. And generally speaking, when people come in and ask me for tomatoes to grow in a container, we sort of groan internally thinking this just isn't going to work real well because they want to grow, champion or early girl in a container. Sure, 15-gallon pot or oak barrel, but a small pot, no. These are intended for home gardeners, people on balconies, people with apartments where you just don't have the room for a full-on tomato plant. You just want to grow some tomatoes for fun. These miniature tomatoes are really great, and there's a ton of them out there. So I'm going to really embark on some testing this year to see how they taste. I've only grown a couple and they were fine, but I'd like to grow more of them. I'm not going to put them out in the garden. Why bother? It only gets, you know, a foot by a foot. I'll keep them in pots and see how they do. Our procedure at Red Barn is that we start tomatoes in March for sale in April.
But that's when you're doing the regular tomatoes, not
regular tomatoes. That's right. And we do them on warm benches. We actually germinate them on heating pads in our office, and then we move them out to heating pads in the greenhouse, and we shift them as fast as we can. And I want to emphasize this, and hopefully we'll only say it 100 times this spring. Keep them moving. When it comes to the container size, the worst thing you can do is let your plant sit there and get really root bound in a pot. If it's going to be a delay on getting it into a bigger container or being planted out in the ground, keep it moving. So once your seedling is up in these little peat pellets, they, in our case, go right into quart pots or 4-inch pots, because that's what we're going to sell them in. If you're going to grow it further and have it all season as a miniature tomato, 6-inch pot will probably hold you till about, in Folsom, until about July. You'll find you're watering every single day. So my guess is that this miniature, like the two or three that I've grown so far, will be best in a 12 to 16-inch pot. Something the size of a 5-gallon to 10-gallon nursery container. It can be ornamental, it can be clay, it doesn't matter what it's made out of, but the bigger the better, because in our climate, Sacramento Valley, Folsom included, we're so hot and dry in the summer that you're going to be watering every single day. And the smaller the pot, the more likely it is to get stressed. So if you can go to a bigger container at some stage, great. But these are intended to be kept in containers. That's the whole market for these mini tomatoes. And starting them early isn't a bad idea with something that grows relatively slowly as these do. Regular tomatoes, again, we don't start until, I think we'll get some going mid-February for the early birds who won't stop pestering me about tomatoes early in the season. Other than that, our main crop is March planted for April and May sales, and we continue to plant them, obviously, further into the season. Peppers we're starting now. The few peppers that we grow for sale, the ones that we have trouble getting from our vendors, we start in January because it takes 12 weeks to go from seed to a saleable plant in the case of peppers. They come up, everything's great, and this has happened every time I've done them, and people who grow them commercially tell me the same thing. They just sit there at the first seedling stage, and for like 4 weeks, you wonder what's going on. Then they finally start growing, and they grow in. They're just fine. They're not hard to grow, but they take a lot longer than tomatoes do. So for planting out peppers, late April, early May, which is the earliest we prefer to do it, we are starting them now, 12 weeks ahead of time before they'll be, you know, even ready for sale. And we continue to start them, but we especially get some going early. So tomatoes, March is my usual pattern on anything that's a normal garden tomato. These miniatures, great. And go ahead and start them early. They'll be fun to grow. And again, get them into the biggest pot you can manage by, let's say, mid-spring, early summer, just in terms of keeping them watered is the biggest issue.
So you're talking, excuse me, you're talking about Mary Kay and her mini tomatoes now.
Yeah.
But do I have to, if I want to grow mini tomatoes, I can wait until spring to grow, can't I?
Yeah, they'll be fine. You can start them as late as April, May, and you'll still be getting fruit on through the summer. Now, okay. Some of them, get back to our jargon, are truly determinate. They grow to a certain size, they flower heavily, they fruit a whole bunch all at once, and that's usually kind of it. Now, I want people to understand, determinate tomatoes will usually keep fruiting somewhat, like Roma is a good example, probably the best known determinate tomato. You get your big crop, which is handy for those of you who want to just harvest those, pull out the plant, stick in something else in that spot and be done by mid to late July. They will produce some more fruit, but they're intended for one long crop, basically, one harvest crop. Indeterminate tomatoes are what most of your tomatoes are. 95% of the varieties out there on the market are indeterminate, meaning they keep growing and flowering and fruiting right on in through the summer. And in our climate, they'll still be flowering in September, and those fruit will be ripening in late October, early November. Indeterminate tomatoes get to be big. They're generally anywhere from 6 to 10 foot vines. They definitely need staking or training of some sort, or else they'll run all over the ground. But there is an in-between category. Dwarf indeterminate or semi-determinate. Take your pick. Okay, semi-determinate, like Celebrity, which is really popular. grows and fruits all at once, but keeps growing somewhat and continues fruiting somewhat. So they decided to call that semi-determinate. It's just a little less determinate than other determinate varieties. Does that make sense?
Okay. No, but that's
dwarf,
okay.
Dwarf indeterminate is tight internode distances. That's really what it means. It's a very compact plant. My favorite in that category, let's see, I'm trying to remember the name of one. Principa borghesa, I think, is one of the dwarf indeterminate. And these are, you know, if you look closely, the leaves are very packed very close together. They are just very tight growers. They flower heavily, they fruit a whole lot, and they continue to flower and fruit right on through the season. So dwarf indeterminate is kind of the category most of these miniatures are. They'll grow, they'll flower, they'll fruit, and they'll continue to do so. Check the label, because if it just says determinate, well, enjoy your harvest and then use that pot for something else after about the end of July. Dwarf indeterminate, if it happens to say on the label, then it'll continue to fruit all the way through the summer. It's a great category. I think this really opens up tomato growing for a lot of people who just really haven't had room for it before. You could take a barrel, for example, and make a little pasta garden, as we like to say. You could put a couple of these dwarf tomatoes in there. You could put one of the emerald tower basil or a dwarf basil of some sort. You could even have a small pepper plant in there, like sudachi. No, that's a citrus. What was the one I'm trying to think? I'm getting mixed
don't
up.
Don't ask
on
me
my
about
plant.
Peppers. I don't know.
just very tight growing pepper. You can crowd them in there because in this case, the tomato won't overwhelm the planting. Whereas if you put a, let's say, an early girl or a champion in a barrel, you have one plant in the barrel that's going to fill the whole thing. So these have great potential for home gardeners who are limited for space. We just want to make sure that they're good quality. I know the people that are working on this are real tomato fanciers. They're not going to put something out that's bland and terrible, but it's worth trying in different regions and see how they do. I really hope a lot of you will look for these either at your garden center. Some garden centers are growing them and selling them, or on seed racks, or more likely in seed catalogs. Get some going and let us know what your results are at the end of the season, which ones you liked and which did well for you, especially for those of you gardening in limited spaces.
And Mary Kay continues, I really appreciate your clear and easy to understand information on pruning fruit trees. I'm giving my trees a critical eye now for considered cuts. And keep listening, Mary Kay, because we're going to do a little more about pruning fruit trees a little later in the show. And she continues, just for fun, I always pot up some blackjack fig cuttings to give away. Mm-hmm. I love that idea.
Yeah, blackjack. Okay. Go ahead.
This year, I'll try doing that with blueberries, too. Gardening, always an experiment. Thanks for your sage advice.
Sage advice. There we go. Blackjack is a dwarf fig. It's a very compact growing fig that appears to be, from anything I could figure out, pun intended, a dwarf variant of Black Mission. The fruit is certainly very similar to Black Mission. And figs root really, really, really easily from cuttings. This is one of those things, if you've got a really good fig variety and you want to share it with friends and you're pruning it in the winter, just like Mary Kay is doing, take those cuttings, stick them in some reasonably fast-draining soil, water, and if you do it at the right time of year, which is basically late January, February, early March, there's a very high likelihood they'll root before they wither. So you can give them away and your friends and neighbors can enjoy them. We have a customer who has some sort of Adriatic fig. It's an Adriatic region where the figs are usually pale green to yellow, almost white. They're very soft. They're extremely sweet and juicy. She has no idea what the name is. So she's just been bringing them in, cuttings into us to root and grow and sell because it's an astounding fig. We don't know exactly what it is. So we just call it Adriatic fig. But that's the only way we would ever get this is by someone just bringing us cuttings. Figs that you buy are not grafted. They're grown from cuttings. You can do it yourself. If you got a friend with a fig tree and you really like the variety, just ask them for a few cuttings while the tree is dormant and go ahead and root them. I don't know if blueberries will root. I know that they're grown that way, but I don't know if it'll be easy for home gardeners to do. As you say, gardening, always an experiment. Thanks for writing.
Okay, so next question. And this is from Donna Lou, who writes, hello, Don and Lois. I love your show and listen religiously. Ooh, Don, we're a religion.
That's right. That's right.
Donna Lou says,
welcome to the congregation.
I live in Suisun City. That's in the Delta, isn't it, Don?
You bet.
Okay. I live in Suisun City, and last year for my birthday, starting in January, we removed our lawn and planted fruit trees and roses. I found a few varieties of ultra dwarf apple trees, and that's capitalization there, in bare root form. They're growing nicely, but in November, I noticed one of them started producing small clusters of fruit. This has happened maybe six or eight tiny apples growing. I think this tree is confused about the season. Should I remove this fruit or just let it go, see what happens? Thanks for your advice.
I have one. I don't have the ultra dwarf, but I have one apple that always pops out a few blooms in the late summer. It's kind of funny. It's actually my Anna apple, which is a low chill apple variety that has done remarkably well for me. And it does this. It'll have a bloom that'll set some fruit, and they try to develop and they don't develop properly. Trees will often do that as a result of stress. I hate to say that. So it's a suggestion that your plant got a little bit stressed. In my case, it probably is drought stress, but it also just seems to be that one that does it. And I have a whole bunch of apples. So it does seem to be a fairly unique problem with that particular low chill apple for whatever reason. It's not a problem. It's just that those fruit will not develop properly. So go ahead and remove them. But this brings us to what are these ultra dwarf patio fruit trees? These are not, we talked earlier in the program about dwarf or miniature tomatoes. Those are bred as miniature tomatoes. That's a unique variety that stays miniature. These are normal apples, varieties you've heard of. I'm looking at the list of one company here, pacificgroves.com. Beverly Hills, Dorset Golden, Yellow Delicious. They have apricots, they have cherries, and so on that they're selling as ultra dwarf fruit trees. They're just grafted onto the dwarfingest rootstock they can get. And in the case of apples, there's been a lot of breeding on apples, thanks to the British, who love apples and have hundreds and hundreds of varieties. They have come up with the Malling rootstocks, M111, M29, et cetera, the name that you're going to see on the rootstock, one of which is extremely dwarfing. You can graft onto it and keep it like a little bush. You can keep whatever the variety is, Golden Delicious, Anna, Dorset, as if it were a little shrub. You will need to stake it forever because these rootstocks are pretty stunted. They're pretty dwarf themselves. So they are keeping the plant small, perhaps by being themselves very dwarf. So the plant will need to be staked or trained as an espalier is a very popular way to do this, or grown in a container. And one of the websites I looked at has people growing them in 18-inch, 24-inch planters. You're growing a tree, except that it's not. You're growing it like a bush in a pretty large container. That's not quite the size of a half wine barrel, but it's getting up there. So something equivalent to a 15-gallon nursery container or something bigger like a 20-inch or as I say, a half barrel would do it. And you can keep it as a little shrub. And of course, if it's a spur fruiting type, like an apple or a pear or a cherry, you can then once the fruiting wood is there, you can prune as hard as you want. As long as you don't remove the fruiting wood, you will get fruit on this tree year after year after year. They can go on for a very, very long time. In the valley, and Sassoon City's in the delta, but you get almost as hot as we do, and you're certainly windier than we are, the container is going to dry out. That's going to be your biggest issue. I guarantee that by the middle of the first summer in that container, you will be watering almost for sure daily, which is easy enough to do. I've had customers do this kind of thing. I've had them do blueberries in containers and things like that, and they just run a drip line up into it with an emitter that one or two emitters, depending on the size of the container. And one customer who's an engineer told me he figured out it took exactly 6 minutes with the drip system running for water to come out the bottom. He could see it draining through. So that's what it took to hydrate the whole root zone. And he had it run 6 minutes every single day. And he got great results with fruit trees and things like that in containers, as long as the drip system ran every day. Can you keep that up forever? Well, of course not. I mean, it's a plant in a pot. I suppose you could technically bonsai it if you wanted to do that. That's pretty much what you're doing. But as long as you give it the water that it needs, it does need to be in the sun, at least half day sun, 4 to 6 hours minimum. So it's going to dry out quickly because it's in essentially full sun and you're in a windy zone. I would recommend running a half inch drip line behind your containers. Have a quarter inch tube going up into the pot or spaghetti tubing. Personally, I prefer the quarter inch tube. Have an emitter with a determined output, one or two of them right there on the soil at the base of the tree, and plan on running it daily. And as I say, he tested and found it took 6 minutes with his soil for water to go all the way through and come out the bottom. That's what we want to see. A thorough watering every single day will very, very likely hear from about 1st of May all the way into October or even into November if we get any of our dry north winds. So it can be done. You just have to be prepared to water it. And it's going to be something that's going to be really simple on a timer. I mean, you could just put a battery operated timer on the hose faucet and have it come on each day for a few minutes. You just need to test and see with your soil, your situation, how long it takes to properly hydrate that root zone.
When you do something like that, should you mulch the pot?
I think it's actually a really good idea to put mulch of some sort on your larger containers as we get into the hot weather. It can be bark, it can be more soil, it can be whatever. Yes, I do think that's a good idea to help shade the roots a little bit. It just gives you a little bit more of a margin of error. And also, I like to see these pots sitting on the ground, not on concrete, because then they can root into the soil below. And that gives you another margin of error. I've had a lot of plants that survive simply because that I'm growing in containers simply because they rooted down into the soil below. And that gave them the insurance if I wasn't giving them quite enough water, any individual hydration, they could tap into what was down below. So that would be a good plan as well. On your patio will be harder than sitting on the dirt near your patio. And I would say apples and pears are probably the best for this. I noticed this one company has every fruit you can think of available on these dwarfing rootstocks. The thing is, rootstocks for apples have been developed specifically for this purpose for decades. The rootstocks for stone fruits, peaches, plums, nectarines, apricots, not so much. There are rootstocks for dwarfing cherries, and this has one advantage. Remember how I tell you we don't recommend cherry trees anymore because of the spotted wing Drosophila getting into the fruit? Well, the one thing you can do to prevent it from getting into the fruit is cover the tree with a frost blanket or row cover, as we call it, as the fruit is beginning getting ready to turn color. The ovipositing on cherries occurs just as they start to blush, and especially when they get fully red. So that's when they really go after them. Well, they can't fly through frost blanket, row cover. It's a mesh that allows light in, but blocks these little spotted wing Drosophila. So we do have people who really want to grow cherries. And I said, all right, get your dwarfingest cherry. Craig's Crimson is a good example. Get it on the dwarfingest rootstock. Colt is a good example. So Craig's Crimson on Colt, dwarf variety on a dwarfing rootstock. Put it in a container, prune it as hard as you can in the summer. Once you've got that fruiting wood, especially they fruit on spurs, and plan to cover it just as the fruit begins to turn color. And people who do this have actually gotten worm-free fruit. So if you're willing to go to all that trouble, this is one way that you could grow cherries. And this is where the dwarfingest rootstock is going to be a key part of the process.
Okay, back to the question about the apples. You said that your apple flowered in unusual time.
It does, it's somewhat. I mean, we're talking about some blooms popping out when you don't expect them.
Yeah. So, and you've gotten little tiny apples occasionally on this one particular tree. Is it always the same spur that's giving you those little apples?
You know, I haven't really observed that carefully, so I'll have to check on that this summer.
If you had that, you could cut off that one little spur.
I don't know that that's what it is. We don't really know what causes this. I do know that in the case of this apple, it's a low chill variety. And in the case of, I have a lilac on my property that blooms in the fall every year. It's one of the Descanso hybrids that was bred for Southern California. Same thing, whatever happens in terms of chilling requirements, it doesn't have any, I guess. And so it pops out its bloom in the late summer. You'd think that would be cool, except it really isn't, to have a lilac blooming in September. It looks weird, and then it doesn't bloom well in the spring. But in the case of the apple, it's probably a stress. It's probably watering related. It's just a few here and a few there. It does happen on them, and they do try to set fruit. But no, to answer the question, they aren't going to develop properly.
Okay. So the next question comes from Tanya in Davis. Hi, Don and Lois. I purchased two Cordyline Australis, Torbe Dazzler.
That's a nice one, yeah.
I don't know what that is. I've never heard of that.
Cordylines look like palms. Some of them are grown as house plants. Most people know Cordyline fruticosa. The tea plant or Thai plant is grown as a house plant. But these are the hardy cordylines, which became incredibly popular about 20 years ago. Designers love them. They're great accent plants. They look sort of like a aloe or agave, that kind of dramatic leaf, except they make a trunk like a palm tree. And so they just get taller and taller and taller. And they're great garden plants, except that a problem seems to have happened here.
And the picture she sent, the explosion of leaves at the top.
Yes.
Well, it looks sort of like a prickly lollipop, but that clump of leaves at the top is up where the wires are in her backyard. So that is a tall plant.
They get big
Okay.
eventually. They do it pretty slowly. These are, I'm guessing, 8 to 10 years old would be my guess from the size of them.
Well,
Nice.
she said, I purchased these two a few years ago and planted them in the backyard. Both were growing fairly or similarly well, but now I have one that just looks like an old mop on the top. As you can see from the photo, there is very healthy heads of foliage towards the bottom of the affected one, but the top of that plant looks dead as can be. Do I need to cut this, leave it, and take off the dead leaves, leave the stick?
I
I
would cut it
really
off.
like the variegation of these plants, but also don't want to waste time getting the cousin it look, cutting one down and out if that's what it's going to look like forever.
No,
Farmer
this part
Fred
of that.
says life is too short to put up with a problem plant, and he's right. I appreciate the help. Happy New Year's to you both, and thank you for being here for us gardeners.
Yeah, it looks like it rotted, and there's a bunch of reasons that could happen. If it were mine, I would start, either cut it down first, or before you do that, just start pulling away the leaves and see what's going on in there, because it's very likely a soft rot. Bacterial soft rot gets in and kills all the tissue around it, and everything above that point just collapses. It's not going to resprout there. It might resprout further down on the trunk, but that could take quite a while. And so I would just go ahead and cut that off. And indeed, the second picture is great. There's signs of new sprouts trying to come up from the base. So let's let them go, and it doesn't look like the problem has extended any further down the trunk. This happens. It happens to palm trees sometimes, where they just something gets in, moisture gets trapped in there, insects get in there in some cases and tunnel around, and then bacteria gets going, and that's the end of it. In this case, it looks pretty isolated to the top of the tree, so I would just cut that out clean, as you seem to be inclined to do, and it'll resprout probably from the base, as it's since it's already done so. I assume those will form new leaders.
So when you say cut it off clean, do you mean cut the whole thing down to
Cut
the
the
groin
thing.
down to the bottom?
Cut it down to where it's
Okay.
growing down at the bottom. If you look at the
Okay.
other one on the second picture, you can see there's a sprout. It looks like a sprout on the trunk of that one.
On the side,
It
yeah.
is hypothetically possible that if you just cut this to a stub, it would sprout, but I don't think so. These don't typically have a lot of growth buds ready to go on their main stem. There are plants, like boxwood and privets and things, where you can cut them anywhere you want, they'll resprout. Other plants, those buds, if they were present, get covered over by bark and they slowly die out, or they just lose vitality. There are some plants you can cut back and they'll sprout, and some plants you can't. If you cut a juniper back by half, pretty good chance it'll just die at that point. If you cut a Pittosporum tabira back by half, it'll just resprout instantly. So it's important to know, if you're pruning evergreen shrubs and things like that in your yard, which ones will sprout, which ones will not. This is a case where it's rare to have growth buds on the main trunk. So I would just take it all the way down to the new growth of the base. All the energy will then of that still fairly good sized root system will go into that. And I'd say by the end of next summer, you'll have a nice looking cordyline shrub next to your nice looking cordyline tree.
Okay, so here's another question that came in. This is from a fellow in Davis. We have three citrus in pots under the eaves, south-facing location, Mexican limes, and either side of a lemon tree. I have fertilized with citrus food, but not since early summer. I turned off irrigation to the pots when it first rained. I think that was October. The soil looks damp on top, and you can see the chard in the left pot seems happy. What would you guess is about the yellow leaves? Ferts or water or something else? Ferts?
FERTS is short for fertilizer. That was just
Ah.
abbreviating it. So this is the most common question, as we say on the show here almost every week, from about mid-November through March, is why are my citrus leaves yellow? And the answer is they're just reacting to cold weather and partly just lack of sunlight, but the cold weather in particular. Citrus are subtropical plants, and any subtropical plant that goes below 50 degrees, it isn't necessarily harmed by it all that much. But one of the things that will happen is, in some cases, some evergreens, including citrus, the older leaves, and then eventually most of the leaves will yellow somewhat. And in particular, lemons and limes are notorious for it. So Meyer lemon, especially. We get this question all the way until the soil temperature or the night temperatures start bumping up in March. And I have found that 50 degrees seems to be a rough threshold. And when we get above 50 pretty consistently, which is usually first or second week of March, the questions go away because the problem solves itself. It's a great opportunity for us to sell someone fertilizer. And there's nothing wrong with fertilizing your citrus, especially in late winter as we're coming out of the cold weather and going towards the warmer weather. And it will seem as though, I mean, I could just do this. Yes, buy this fertilizer, apply it March 1. Look, it magically solved your problem. But in fact, what
That's
solved your
That's not what he meant. Don't take that advice.
Well,
don't
it's fine.
Put that out.
Feed it March 1 if you want to. Feed it in February. It will then the nitrogen will be there when the plant is making more use of it. But it's just a temperature phenomenon, and citrus are notorious for it. And there's a spectrum. This is another important point. Citrus exists on a spectrum of cold hardiness from yuzu and sudachi and trifoliate orange, which can go down to 15 degrees with no problem, talking Fahrenheit here, to Mexican lime, which are damaged at 31, 30 degrees. And lemons and limes and citron are at the tender end of the spectrum. So they're more affected by cold nights, more affected by cold temperatures, more likely to be injured by frost. But that's not what we're looking at here. We finally had a significant frost on our farm. Okay, third week of December is the latest I've ever seen a first frost here. I had a light frost in November that I took a picture of, but it didn't really count. We had two mornings when it was clear enough for the heat to be lost to the sky. We had actual frost. That's not what we're talking about with this citrus yellowing. It's just plain cold temperatures. And anything below 45, 50 degrees is continuing it. Keep in mind, cold injury in plants is cumulative and reversible. Okay, let me say that again.
Reversible?
Cold injury in plants is cumulative. So each day that's colder than the plant likes is causing harm. It's also reversible. So on a day that gets down to 34 degrees, but where we get up to 60 during the day, that higher temperature balances out the cold temperature to some degree. So you see less injury in a normal winter here than in a winter when we've had 4 weeks straight where it didn't get above 45 degrees. So I've got to say that the biggest impact you're seeing right now is from 3+ weeks, almost 4 weeks, where it was 41 to 45 degrees. That's colder than subtropical plants are optimal at. And so it causes this yellowing, and there was no reversing it on any of those days. We had 4 weeks straight where the cumulative injury was not reversing. So I expect to see more injury to subtropicals, particularly citrus, in the sense of this yellowing of the leaves. But it's only injury in the sense that the plant isn't photosynthesizing as well. It's not dropping leaves. It's not getting burn on the leaf from frost. It's just been the accumulated injury of colder nights than are optimal for any subtropical. Every sunny day is better. So cold night, sunny day, not so bad as cold night, cold day. The injury is cumulative but reversible. That's the important thing. So even though you get some injury, the plant will outgrow it unless it gets to the point of actual direct injury to the foliage and the new growth, which would be frost injury. That's different than cold injury.
So you say it's reversible. Do you mean that those yellow leaves are going to turn green?
Yeah, in March, about the middle of March, they always do. And we stop getting the question.
The same leaf?
Yes.
Wow.
And we go through this every year, every single year.
Wow.
Go back and listen to shows from previous years, how many times we've answered the question about yellow leaves on citrus. Yellowing leaves on deciduous plants, you know, things that actually have, they'll typically just drop. Okay.
Yeah, that's what I'm...
Some species will react, but citrus, they'll yellow. And if you looked out at my mandarins right now, you know, the new mandarin orchard, it's really interesting how different the varieties are in this regard. So my satsumas and all their relatives are dark green and fine, no problem whatsoever. Satsumas are very cold tolerant. The clementine is a hybrid between a mandarin and an orange. So it has some orange parentage. They're kind of yellow. Well, you know, side by side, you can see the difference on the young trees, especially. None of them are harmed by it, but there's a distinct difference. Lemons and limes and grapefruit, I'll throw in there, are generally yellow or green to begin with. This is an important point. They're not as dark green as oranges and mandarins in general. And lemons and limes, being a little more frost tender, just based on their parentage, are likelier to show this yellowing injury. And so, yeah, mid-March, they magically outgrow it. We stop getting those questions. I always like to swap notes with the master gardeners who man the table down at the farmer's market. And I said, just watch, you know, check the soil temperatures, check the night temperatures, whichever metric you prefer. As we start getting closer to tomato planting season, those yellowing leaves on the citrus questions will magically go away and the leaves will green back up. So it's just a cold temperature reaction. Hopefully we won't have to answer this question too many more times, but about every 2 weeks, we should probably just throw it out there as a public service announcement.
So, Don, I want to remind our listeners that this is January. We're going to have at least a week of no rain. Mm-hmm. And this is the perfect time to go out there and pull those weeds because, man, they're getting big already.
Walking around this morning on my property, I can tell you that the Velcro plant, that are known as cleavers or bedstraw or sticky willy or a bunch of other names, is at least a month ahead of schedule this year for whatever reason. We got the rain early in October. We had some warm temperatures. Then we went into the winter temperatures. It's very cold tolerant as well. Most of them are about 6 inches tall and ready to go into their running across the ground phase. And they'll be blooming within just a few weeks. They're the phase I normally take pictures of them at in February. They're extremely easy to control still. Chop them, mulch them, cover them with tarps, whatever you like to do. Because a month from now, they'll be climbing up into your rose bushes and sticking to everything. So yes, that particular one is ahead of schedule and doing very well, thanks to all the rainfall that it's had. A quick programming note, for those of you that listen to the broadcast locally, the program that aired on New Year's Day was a rerun, a rebroadcast. For those of you that listen to the podcast, it was a new show that Lois and I had put together. The only reason this might be of relevance to you is that in that program, we talked in a fair detail about quick pruning tips for certain groups of fruit trees, peaches, plums, nectarines, all that kind of thing. We'll be doing follow-up on that topic in an upcoming show. But if you want to listen to that part and you listen to the local broadcast only, podcast listeners got the right thing, you can go to davisgardenshow.com or KDRT.org and go to the Davis Garden Show page. And each of those, you'll find a link to the program and you can listen to it on your computer. Everyone else should have heard it just fine. But for whatever reason, that week, we at KDRT ran a rerun. So KDRT.org, Davis Garden Show, or DavisGardenShow.com to listen to our quick pruning tips for certain groups of fruit trees.
So we end our session here with a quote from Farmer Fred. Life is too short to put up with a problem plant.
Yes, thank you to the listener who sent that in. We appreciate that. You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore
and Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.
Be sure to check out some of the other great programming here at KDRT on Wednesdays from 2 to 3 p.m. You can join Karen Lisi for In the Key of Folk. It's music that will keep you humming or dancing along, perhaps both. The focus is on traditional and current folk music, Americana and bluegrass with Celtic, Nordic, and Spanish infusions, wherever Karen's travels and interests take her. In addition, the music of contradance, an American folk tradition that came with English and other settlers, will often be threaded through the hour. Don't know it? Check it out. That's In the Key of Folk, Wednesdays at 2. Replays during the week, so for the rebroadcast time, just check out the schedule guide.